This is episode 7 of Encounter Points.
Welcome to this episode of Encounter Points. I'm Bill Schmidt.
And I'm Ken Hellenius.
In our previous episode, our topic was mercy. Merciful people and a merciful God, opening the door to joy. Joy, in turn, energizes our pursuit of the Catholic to-do list. First, go forth to form real encounters with other individuals. Second, go forth to evangelize society. Spread the good news.
Well, then, in this episode, our tour of the components of joy that help us on our mission brings us to the topic of music. I think this is a really fun stop on the tour for both of us, I dare say. I mean, come on, Bill, am I right? I'm a fan of both kinds of music, country and Western. And I've even done chanting as a form of prayer, you know, in the context of Gregorian chant.
Oh, well, I'm an accordionist who likes to spread joy with occasional performances. I write the songs that make the young girls cry.
My friend, you sorely misunderestimate yourself. You write the songs that make the whole world cry. Well, that was mean. I apologize. But honestly, now that we've tuned up our both joke and humor meters and our music meters, let's get the conversation going. Well, Bill, hello.
Hello. Hello, Ken. I just know that this podcast is going to be music to my ears.
Oh, dear.
Sorry.
Oh, man. Sing to me. Sing to me.
Sing low, sweet chariot.
Well, Bill, tonight we want to talk about continuing these ideas of joy.
Yes, that's right.
One of the things that brings great joy to many people's lives is music.
It is.
You can find joy in all parts of music, right? In terms of the production of music, singing or playing an instrument, going to a concert, having it on in the background as you're doing other things.
That's right.
The get up of going to a symphony concert.
Yeah.
You know, all of these sorts of things are all aspects of music that have music at the center, but also are doing other things.
A very good point about music. It really does evoke all sorts of reactions within the individual and within society. Everything from evoking memories and, mm-hmm. in fact, memories that trigger all five senses. Can be associated with a particular song that you remember from your youth or whatever.
Sure. Some people see music. Synthesia, you know, this idea of where they've got something going on in their head where they hear a tune and they see it as green or whatever. Yes. It engages all aspects, right? I mean, even you could be sitting in a concert or you can have a guy drive up behind you on the road who's got the bass thumping, it's annoying, but at the same time, it's like, I'm annoyed because I don't want your musical choices, you know, trumping the ones I'm listening to.
Right.
Here I am enjoying a pastoral symphony by Beethoven.
Yes.
You got this guy driving up behind me, you know, bass is thumping, you know, hearts are jumping, all that kind of stuff. Sorry.
Yes.
Get into my, my young MC there, but, you're right. It engages all aspects of our kind of physicality.
Right.
As well as the psyche.
That's right. That's right. And therefore, has to be used or would wisely be used in new evangelization, since it's a way to get great reactions from other folks who might not know how much beauty in music originated from and still stems from the Catholic Church, or just from a life of faith and the beauty and wonder of closeness to God. All of that is a beautiful expression of love that's perhaps best put in music.
there's this idea that you know, when we participate in singing, like in prayer,
right?
You know, even in our liturgy, for right. example, of course, music can play and does play an important role. The most solemn moments, like the highest, most solemn form of Mass, is that which is sung.
Yes,
sung through
that's
the gospel
right.
is chanted. The gospel is sung. The Eucharistic prayer is sung.
Yes.
This is it certainly in the extraordinary form, or in what we think of as the pre-Vatican II,
right.
Tridentine, right? Or the High Mass, the solemn High Mass was entirely sung.
Yeah.
You know, and even now, when you go to, you know, the principal Mass in any given Catholic parish on a Sunday is going to be the one that has the full choir.
That's
you know,
right.
And,
that's right.
And music. And it's very engaging. And it's clearly in outward appearances, it's more solemn than the low Mass or the 7 a.m. Sunday morning Mass that has no singing at all.
That's right. People are barely getting through the half hour.
People are barely
yes,
awake.
No.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. But at the same, and I say external because obviously the Mass is something beyond us anyways.
Exactly.
And so it's just as solemn. But in the external forms that engage the human person,
right.
There's more going on in a Mass where they're singing.
Very much so. Very much so. There's more going on in every sense, within the individual, within the community, the congregation.
Mm-hmm. And certainly within each individual participant.
Very right? much so. Very much so, including for the priest, I would imagine. And many priests now have taken to, you know, voluntarily, proactively singing or chanting more of the Mass to kind of remind people what might have slipped away a bit over decades, namely the importance and the glory and the wonder of the Mass.
And it works particularly well when they have a beautiful voice and they can carry it too.
That helps a lot, yes.
You know, there's this other, I remember when I was a Dominican, that, you know, we had Saturday morning choir practice,
right.
you know, and we would be practicing the pieces that we'd be singing at the Sunday Mass, and we would be practicing the chants that we, you know, because of course morning, evening prayer were all chanted.
Right,
and so
right.
even though we did this every day, it required focus. And it's really interesting because it required focus both so that we were so familiar with it
right.
that we could actually not have to focus on it while we were doing it, so that we could actually be in prayer.
Very
you know, it's
yeah.
this repetition,
right?
You know, the mother of study as well as the mother of comedy. The,
yeah,
the,
yes.
the key to comedy is,
right.
as I tell people all the time. But you know, it's through the muscle memory that we develop that you
That's
get
right.
that you get able then to be freed to contemplate, be freed
yes.
to meditate. You know, and so as we were chanting the Psalms in choir, you know, it's like I could really be thinking about the words rather than, oh, did I sing that note too low? You know, or
interesting.
Whatever. But
yeah.
it required vigilance
right.
at the appropriate times, like choir practice.
Right. My first instinct would be that if I were in such a religious community with constantly sung or chanted morning prayer, evening prayer, etc., I'm afraid that I would find it tough some mornings and some evenings, really wanting instead to just recite the prayers without music. And I'm not sure whether it would be, you know, I certainly hope it wouldn't be in the spirit of wanting to get it over with, but wanting maybe seeing it not as a distraction, but as an extra exertion that would distract me from the meaning of the words rather than accentuate the meaning of the words. Does that ever happen, or?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question because,
yeah.
of course, I go to Mass here in town at St. Stanislaus Parish, which is the extraordinary
that
form.
That is the extraordinary form, yes.
And at 7 a.m. or I think 7:30, there's a low Mass, which is, you know, much shorter
right.
than the 10 o'clock solemn High Mass.
Right.
Sometimes I do want to go to the low Mass because I want to, you know,
right.
I'm there to pray.
Right.
And I look at it as I want it to be just me and Jesus this morning.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
But then at 10 a.m., it's like, I want to go and I want to be immersed and bathed in
beauty and the solemnity. I think that's a very good way of putting
it. So either way, it's, you know, yeah, but I agree. I mean, there are times when you want your own, you want to regulate your own progressive solemnity, you might say.
I like that, you
know?
Yes.
I don't know.
And even while I mention that possible negative side to the occasional use of music, I was thinking about this, namely the Divine Mercy Chaplet, which I like to say, or rather sing. Most of the time when I start reciting the Divine Mercy Chaplet, before too long, I find myself singing it or chanting it, because that's how I learned it, from the EWTN video of the chaplet being prayed at Stockbridge at Eden Hill. And so it does come, because it comes naturally sung, I think I am actually getting more out of the words and more out of the whole experience. It is more immersive, I found, and I don't think I would have even remembered or been captured by the devotion on TV if it hadn't been made more immersive by the music. That's interesting now that I think about it.
Yeah. It's funny that you say, you know, as I say, or as I recite, and yet it comes, you find yourself falling into the music. The
yeah, that's one case where I do.
So that would be one where I would probably choose the verb as I pray the Divine Mercy Chaplet.
Well, that's fair enough. Right. Exactly, to give the option and the full experience.
There's that very famous quotation, you know, he who sings prays twice.
Right.
You know, and I think it's commonly attributed to St. Augustine.
Right.
And I was kind of digging, you know, looking for, as I was doing my research for our chat tonight, and I found another quotation from Augustine that really, I think, is quite interesting.
Yeah.
And it's really a warning, in a way.
Oh, my. Okay.
So, St. Augustine warns, quote, "On the whole, I am inclined, though I am not propounding any irrevocable opinion, to approve the custom of singing in church, that by the pleasure of the ear, weaker minds might be roused to a feeling of devotion. Yet, whenever it happens that I am more moved by the singing than by the thing that is sung, I admit that I have grievously sinned and that I should wish rather not to have heard the singing at all."
Wow.
And that's from the Confessions. And I was kind of interested by this, by this, because, you know, there's this principle in liturgical music that we sometimes lose, and that is that the music should always serve the text.
Yes.
Because it's the text of the liturgy, the text of our prayers that express our heart.
Gee, that's right.
And music, when music absolutely enhances that to a point, then there becomes a point when it becomes a concert, when it becomes an expression of the musician. You know, you go to a jazz concert, you don't go necessarily to hear the words or even to hear the notes as written. You go to hear this interpretation and this performance.
Yes, that's right.
And so certainly people can be in rapture in a jazz concert. Nobody denies that.
Right.
But in the context of prayer, especially liturgical prayer, where we are all together.
Right.
You know, a performer is usurping the community.
That's right.
And I think that's really kind of what Augustine is kind of hinting at here in this. He's like, when the music becomes more important than the words, so in other words, when the music becomes more important than the prayer and the and everything that goes with that, then it's an issue. And he says it's a grievous sin. This comes from Confessions, which at points he's very harsh on himself. So maybe when he says grievous sin, he doesn't necessarily mean a mortal sin.
Right.
But something for us to think about, I think.
Yeah. And you're reminding me of what we said last week about art and beauty, where I think we expressed a bit of a caveat about how at its best and at its most beautiful, art is a reflection of God and is fairly transparent and a truly non-manipulative reflection of God in his beauty and in his awe. Whereas art, when not done well, becomes kind of manipulative in the sense that the artist is trying to evoke a certain reaction in us or a certain emotion in us. And so it's much preferable for both the art and the music to flow very authentically and freely and transparently from the heart of the individual, and in this case, from the heart of the liturgy and the scriptures, so that there's a purity to it.
So they express the mind and the heart of the church.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, instead of the heart and the mind only of the performer or of the writer of the piece.
Right. Yes. Right.
Yeah, I think that's a good caveat for both of those things. And probably for some of the other things we've discussed in previous weeks, like humor, where humor can be pure and, well, pure humor might be. I don't know how often we hear that anymore.
Thing, right?
Yes, but
there's clean.
Humor pure. Humor can become mean spirited, manipulative, and generally toxic if we're not careful. Yeah. Whereas it can also edify.
Now, there's an aspect here. This kind of reminds me of reading Plato's Republic when I first went to college.
Yeah.
And, you know, here he's kind of attempting to lay out how a society should be built. And he actually speaks a lot about education in there. And one of the things that he requires in the education is education in music.
Ooh, I like that.
For all children.
And, wow.
And the reason that he does so is that music is formative because we respond to music both consciously and kind of in ways that we can't predict at first, and it forms us. So he actually says in The Republic, Book 3, musical training is a more potent instrument than any other because rhythm and harmony find their way into the inward places of the soul on which they mightily fasten, imparting grace and making the soul of him who is rightly educated graceful or of him who is ill-educated ungraceful. You know, this idea of harmony. Harmony helps, you know, when we can hear when things are discordant,
right?
You know, when they don't fit. Well, at least we could prior to Schoenberg and the 12-tone atonal music of the modern age. But but harmony is what we also aim for in our actions, right? When we talk about virtue and prudence ruling the virtues, is everything being in harmony so that we are just
like that.
And we are temperate. All of these things are in proper relationship to one another. They are in harmony.
That's right.
Like the pleasing music that we have learned from our childhood.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
Now, the flip side to this is that the Plato also then says only the right kind of music should be taught. Only the right kind of music, you know, that is in harmony, and music should never change. So this is the other side to it. And actually, I think it kind of has echoes in our day, right, too. But as he says, music and gymnastic, because gymnastic was this other, you know, harmony of the body,
right.
The physical body, you know, being in well-toned and those sorts of things.
Uh-huh.
Again, same words that we use for music, right?
Oh, interesting.
Tones.
I like that.
Yeah, so he says music and gymnastic should be preserved in their original form and no innovation made. So Damon tells me, and I can quite believe him, he says that when modes of music change, the fundamental laws of the state always change with them.
Ooh.
And I'm kind of reminded of, you know, something we chatted before we started recording, this idea that music, maybe when we were both kids, was less, what's the right word, angry?
Yeah, right.
Less... less put downy.
Exactly.
I don't know. You know.
Well, it was more upbeat. Although that might be again a little bit wrong use of terms, but
yeah,
it was more. It was more optimistic. There was a sense of values and virtues, I think, embedded in the music?
Depending on the music, of course.
Well,
I mean,
of course,
all
yes.
country music, and I was raised on both kinds of music, country and Western.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, country music is a lot of, I mean, this is the tradition, right? Cheating songs, drinking songs.
That's true,
you know,
right?
I mean,
yes.
But that said, we associate country music also with patriotic songs.
That's right.
With, you know, songs of the working man, you know,
yes.
These sorts of things. But I think that there's, in great contrast to maybe the most popular music of today, which is, you know, songs about gun violence disrespecting women and things like this.
I know. You know? Yes. Now, it's when I was looking through a book I have about the Thoughts on Everything by Steve Allen, one of my heroes. Yeah,
yeah,
he's a great guy in a lot of ways. Some of his thoughts in that book were a little bit surprising to me, but I had been looking for his thoughts on humor. He was an expert on what makes things funny, but then I saw a comment of his on music, and he noted that, there seems to be almost, unfortunately, an equal proportion of love and hatred in the human heart or in our world. But when it comes to music, he noticed that by far there's much more music about love than about hatred. Mm. And it makes me think of Paul McCartney song, you know, Silly Love Songs, where it's a kind
yeah,
of
yeah.
silly, happy celebration that there's so many love songs.
Yeah. Well, and Kermit the Frog would tell you, of course, that there are actually tons of songs about rainbows.
Right.
But I'm not
yes.
going to lie to you. I've done a lot of thinking, and I can't come up with any other than the rainbow connection.
That's true. That's true. Well, you know, I think as a frog, he probably was not well-versed sorry. Yeah, keep using
this
these terms.
This entire topic was written so that you could deliver all the puns, wasn't
no,
it?
No, I'm inspired actually by your use of the word tone gymnastics there.
That was it. That was.
I thought. Yeah. No. I'm not. Now I'm noticing every word I say, which of course I try never to do.
Right.
But the downside of what Steve Allen was saying there was about today's culture. It seemed to me that whereas during his life he saw or heard less music that was marked by hatred. And came to think that, you know, music might be incompatible with hatred. You're right that nowadays there's a surprising amount of music in our popular culture that is marked by hatred. And I think it is food for thought whether, you know, does that content change the mode of expression? Does it is it possible to write a beautiful song about hatred? I guess beauty is in the ear of the beholder in
this
case.
That's right.
But still, it's a cautionary note. I'm sorry. It just keeps happening.
It's a cautionary tale.
A cautionary tale.
And that gets back to storytelling, which we didn't do.
That's right. But what do you think of that? Is that the case with still today that, you know, love and music are inseparable? Or?
Well, I certainly think, I mean, I think on the whole you're still going to find a preponderance of love songs versus any other type.
That's true.
Now, it may be less wholesome depictions of love.
Right.
I can think of many
more,
of those, you know.
Right. Again, more broken romances.
Yeah,
broken
romances,
hearts, right?
You know, all those sorts of things. But that said, what was it Thomas Aquinas who had a concept that was even the man who goes in, it wasn't Thomas, I think it was actually Chesterton, actually.
Yeah.
Even the man who knocks on the whorehouse door is looking for love. You know?
Right.
Now it's clearly in the wrong place.
Looking for love in all the wrong places.
Thank you. No, that's a classic.
It is.
Now, I'm also reminded, as I think about this and I think about the increase in songs that are less wholesome value,
right.
Maybe. I'm reminded, actually, of all things, of Tolkien's Silmarillion.
Really?
Yeah, the first book of the Silmarillion, or the first part, is called the Ainulindale.
Okay.
And in the Ainulindale, it's this story of creation. And you have the great god Ilúvatar and his cosmology. Ilúvatar is the one that creates this first kind of race called the Ainu, which are really like demigods.
Okay.
And the Ainu, he teaches them to sing, and as they sing, creation comes into being.
Oh, interesting.
And of course, the greatest of the Ainu is named Melkor, and Melkor is a prideful being, and so he introduces a discordant note that you know, brings, again, it destroys the harmony of the music of the Ainu.
Right.
And so he gets reprimanded. And then it happens again, you know, and he gets reprimanded. And Melkor eventually becomes the father of, we think of Sauron, as we would know him in the later stories, of course. Sauron is the great evil kind of demigod of Tolkien's Middle Earth. But this idea of discord being introduced in the context of beautiful harmony.
Right.
The idea of creation being a work of the music reminds me of kind of the Neoplatonic, even the Pythagorean idea of the music of the spheres.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I mean, all creation is giving off music that is in harmony of some sort.
Yes.
And we can't perceive it, but there it is. So this is the, you know, of course, the Middle Ages, they talk about the music of the spheres,
and the
harmony of the spheres. And it appears in Dante, you know, the idea of the spheres and the realms, the music, the great music of heaven. We think of the choirs of angels.
That's right.
You know, and it, what is a choir? But it is that which sings,
that's,
you know.
That's right.
So many things that where music is at the core of creation,
right.
And is the highest pinnacle of creation as well. So
I love it.
Yes. I kind of like all these things.
And it's at the very core of the Liturgy of the Hours, for instance, with the Psalms, etc.
And yeah, I mean, the Psalms themselves are, you know, some of them, again, a Psalm of David, you know,
right.
And we picture King David, you know, plucking
with his
lyre.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly. Yeah,
his harp. So I think as we wrap up our conversation, I wanted to bring something that came to mind. Did not put it in my notes,
okay.
But I think it may edify you.
Please.
Did you ever watch Mad Men?
Not really. I saw snippets.
So mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea is that, you know, this main character Don Draper, who himself is not ever honest. Like, we never really know who Don Draper is.
But, right.
But eventually, you know, and he's this great genius, you know, and he kind of comes up with all of these ad campaigns. The very last scene of Mad Men, and it's been long enough now that I don't think I need to say spoiler alert.
Right, okay.
If you haven't listened, folks, if you haven't watched all of Mad Men, stop now. Don't listen to the next few minutes, okay?
Okay, right.
Giving you a moment now to stop.
I love it, right? Yes, pause. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the very last scene of Mad Men is he's in this, basically in kind of an ashram in California, you know, and he's out on the coast, and this is in the late 60s.
Uh-huh.
And he has this experience of the greatest ad campaign that he could ever come up with.
Uh-huh.
And he has this vision as he's overlooking the sea, and they cut to "I'd like to teach the world to
sing." My goodness.
And I mean, the entire series, 7 years, 7 or 8 seasons, ends with the Coke ad, "I'd like to teach the world to sing." And I'm just reminded of it again, is this idea that is one of the most iconic adverts of all time.
Yes.
And it's all about music and singing.
That's right.
You know?
And it could be conceived of by this obviously very creative someone who had led perhaps a less than ideally virtuously creative life, huh?
But coming back to this idea of harmony and wanting to be, I mean, here he is finding himself, his true self.
Yes,
you know?
Yes. And that was the era, I guess, those years of the Mad Men kinds of behavior. did lead to some good things musically, like that song.
Yeah.
And what was the one that raised funds? We Are the World.
We Are the World. Gosh, that was. Yes, I was 10 years old when that came out.
Right, you know, but I think of that as iconic. Yeah. Reminding me. Yeah. Yeah. So there is something about music that brings us together. All the more reason to at least think of it as a tool for new evangelization in a kind of coarsened culture. To use the word that you used so well a moment ago, a culture of a lot of discord that needs more music, more harmony.
More harmony.
Yeah, exactly. Very interesting.
Well, friend, you know what we're going to have to do, obviously.
Well.
At some point, we're going to have you record our theme song.
Now that's
interesting. Because you are a musician.
Well, thank you. The accordion is my primary instrument. I've invested in an accordion that emulates lots of other instruments, so I don't always have to take the bullying and the emotional beating of being accused of just playing the accordion.
The squeeze
box. Yes, yeah. I can identify as a harpist or clarinetist or whatever, just by
I don't know that those are necessarily any higher in the food chain, are they?
People say that the accordion is a sacred instrument, but it's because when someone opens up the accordion case and starts to play it, everybody says, "Oh my God." that's the only accordion joke I know. Sorry. Yes.
But accordion to you. That's a good one.
Well, very good. Yeah. Very good. Yes. You squeezed that one out of me. Oh, my goodness.
Well, we'll put it in the show notes.
Perfect. See that? The words are everywhere.
They really are.
Transcendental.
Bill, thank you for the conversation.
Thank you very much, Kate. Always a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you for listening to our conversation during this episode 6. You can subscribe to hear future episodes at our website, encounterpoints.com. Our theme music is Leaves by Airtone, licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution License. We hope to encounter you in the next episode of Encounter Points.